Well, welcome to Hope Leads. This is Wes Lane. You know, science tells us that hope is the single greatest determiner of human well-being. One way we pursue kindling and fanning hope with you, the listener, is by talking with men and women who are leaders from different generations, from different geographic areas, from different spheres of influence. But they all have one thing in common. They pursue Jesus and God's unique and purposeful journey for them on the earth. So my hope is that these focused conversations might somehow serve you in a greater understanding of just who our awesome God is and his very purposeful desire and plan that you would live a life of meaning and impact. Well, and I tell you what's especially exciting today is that Mrs. Taylor West not only is with me here in this moment, but she actually participated and joined me in the examination of our guest for the day.
Our incredible guest for the day.
Wasn't she awesome?
Oh my goodness, Wes. What just happened in this interview?
Yeah,
Jill is incredible.
She's a deep well.
Oh my goodness.
I think that anybody listening who... Well, and she's a gal that came out of nothing, and God has directed her steps through
in
adversity,
so many ways,
and all these things,
a lot of adversity,
and now she's running a significant bank in Edmond, but here's the deal, it's not just running a bank. She's transforming culture.
Yes, she is. She absolutely is. Her story is so incredible. Like you mentioned, the way that the Lord has just steered her every, or guided her every step.
Well, I guess we should say her name too. Jill Castilla.
I forgot to do that.
Jill Castilla. Because we knew who it was. Who's the president, CEO, and vice chairman of Citizens Bank of Edmond.
Mm-hmm. No, Jill is absolutely wonderful. I could have sat here and talked to her all day, honestly.
Oh my gosh. And the stuff that she talked about, I mean, at the end, when we got to talking about redlining in the community it's remarkable.
Yeah. So a fun fact about Jill is that she loves, and I mean loves, Pokemon Go. So we learned that you yourself are not a big Pokemon guy, Mr. Wesley.
I'd heard of it.
I've never played, but she honestly kind of sold me on it. I'm really intrigued.
She talked about being at, what, the 40th level or something like that, whatever that is.
As if I wasn't already impressed by her. Okay, so Wes, you're not a Pokemon guy. So what, I know a lot of people watched Pokemon as a child growing up. Maybe that wasn't around in your childhood time. But what did you watch as a kid? I know you were really into Westerns.
I'd say exactly. I mean, on Saturday mornings, I love Tarzan.
Tarzan? So Tarzan? Is that a show?
Back in the day, huh?
I know it was a movie, but was it a show too?
Yeah, so Saturday morning, you'd see Johnny Weissmuller, who was an Olympic wrestler, who they made a movie star as playing Tarzan of the Apes, and he was also Jungle Jim.
So not a cartoon.
These were little movies.
What?
Absolutely.
Movie or TV show?
They were once movies at the theaters that had been become, by the time I rolled around, they would be on in the Saturday morning kids' TV.
So
you could watch those, and those were great, you know. So or after school, you could watch Superman. Superman was a big one.
So television was around when you were a kid then.
It was barely. it was black and white.
That's funny. That's awesome. Well, as much as I could sit here and talk to you
and talk about obscure things
and how ancient you are and all of that good stuff.
But we just get past it. So maybe we should go ahead and go to the interview. So let's do that.
Let's
listen to our interview with Jill Castilla. Well, our guest today is Jill Castilla. Jill is the president, CEO, and vice chair of Citizens Bank of Edmond, and she is a marvel and a wonder in the national banking industry. In fact, I just found out that she is now like the I may have to help here, but the American Banker has just named her as like the top banker on the planet.
Yeah, what is that?
It was like insane. In the universe.
Yeah. It was so surprising.
Oh my goodness.
She beat out everybody on Venus. I've been watching this. You've been in the top 25, or you've been watched. You've been on this watch list. You have been skirting the edges of this from someplace. And these are all big dog, the big cities everywhere and all that. And so here you are.
And we're in Edmond. That's a big city.
As we talked about before the show, from America, the flyover country. And you got the top billing. So congratulations on that. But I interrupted myself. So anyway, so we'll let you comment on that in just a second. But she's made, in fact, she made big news just this past spring and summer when she and billionaire business guy and NBA team owner Mark Cuban teamed up to bring solutions to some of the financial challenges people were struggling with in the midst of the pandemic. So Jill Castillo, thank you for coming today.
It's such a honor and pleasure. It's so great to see you, Wes.
Well, it's always a treat to get to see you. And I just want the people to know that you have your Citizens T-shirt on right
dressed
now.
Dressed up.
You are. her assistant asked, will this be videoed? And I said, well, I don't think so, unless we should. But I've seen the cash mobs that you all do, that you go, which is really neat. You go to different places, you invade local spaces, and you bring money and you buy things and you create this sense of camaraderie. That's the big takeaway I've watched with you, Jill. Now, but okay. And I should also comment before I run away with the program, the West Show here. I want to also add that I thought it would be a special treat today by asking the remarkable Mrs. Taylor West to join me on the podcast today. In fact, I actually had gotten a notice that we needed to check a box.
We needed
short millennials.
You take that
or
back.
Actually,
Wesley.
You're a triple box. Short. You're right on the edge between Gen Z and millennials. So we're not quite sure what you are. So that may be a three box.
There we go. That's
that
exactly.
Check.
It's a triple threat.
Yeah,
a triple threat.
She is
a triple threat.
I like the way you see it, Jill.
She's good.
It is an honor to be here with you, Jill. And then Wes, it's all right.
It's nothing special. It's kind of, this is what work every day looks like. So there's a lot of remarkable pieces to your story that I want to drill down on, but I thought what we ought to do first is kind of go back a little bit and just kind of share your background. I mean, I know you're from Eastern Oklahoma, I was just so fascinated. I think the first time I met you, coming by your office several years ago, in fact, this young lady here, because they're all looking pretty young to me these days, but one of our SALT alums. And so I remember first meeting you and was so fascinated that you had been in the military. I mean, my goodness. So so would you just share your background? You somehow came to come to Edmond and at Citizens Bank.
Yeah, so I grew up in Altmulkey, so a little town in Eastern Oklahoma. And my family, my parents divorced when I was really young, and I grew up with my dad. And so my dad had been married several times, and we grew up in Altmulkey. It's a great town. My dad was kind of a jack of all trades, real estate. He sold real estate, and then the real estate market went bust when the oil bust happened, and we lost half of our population in Altmulkey. And then he became a probation and parole officer. And so it was a great, I really enjoyed growing up in Altmulkey. It can be a rough little town somewhat, very diverse community, which I just loved, and really just have friends that are just from all different types of backgrounds. But I worked at the local grocery store at the Homeland, and lived kind of in downtown Altmulkey and would walk there. And
fun.
Was a cheerleader in high school. No. But one of the women that I carried groceries out for was Lurleen Mabry, who was the chairwoman of the local bank. Mm-hmm. And she would help me with like academic competitions or cheerleading camp. And then she would always ask me where I was going to go to college. And my dad was more of when you graduate, he was just hoping to have two daughters that didn't get into any trouble that graduated. Yeah. And he got sent on his way.
That was the finish line right there.
It really was for him. And she really is the one that pushed me. So I went to Oklahoma State. They gave me a little bit more scholarship money, but my dad didn't understand financial aid. So I couldn't apply for help, even though I would have qualified. So I worked at the Homeland there. I would work all night and then go to school all day.
So are you a Homeland shopper now?
I love Homeland.
There you go.
Whenever stay true to you. I don't know if you remember, but their marketing campaign was "Where the Carrots Are" back then.
Do you
remember that?
No.
At all? And I still can't figure out what that means.
I was going to ask you. Okay,
like you can't get carrots anyplace else.
But I still have my Homeland name tag. Carrots. I just loved my experience there. Oh. I never got promoted past grocery bagger, and so I can really pack a mean grocery bag, and you don't want it too heavy, and you know nothing that can be squashed goes on bottom. And so
I respect that skill very much.
Yes, and so I was there for 2 years at Oklahoma State in Stillwater, and I started running out of money. So I'd saved quite a bit during high school, and my savings were getting depleted. I was doing really well in school. I was a chemical engineering major and taking as many classes as I could.
She does it all, folks.
Working all night and then trying to be involved on campus because I really loved being involved in like student government. Mm-hmm. And but then I was really reaching the end. I mean, the cupboards were bare. I was running out of energy. I really didn't have any place to go. And I was carrying groceries out like 2 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday night in Stillwater, which was a big party night. And it happened to be for an Army recruiter. And he said, you know, why are you working so late? And I said, well, I'm trying to pay for school and I'm not going to be able to do it anymore. And he's like, well, apply financial aid. And I said, I can't because I'm not an independent student. And he just said, well, if you enlist in the Army, then you finish basic training and then you can become an independent student. You can qualify for the GI Bill. You can apply for financial aid. And honestly, I still remember that moment. It was just like the heavens opened up and angels started singing. And it was like hope. And the next day I went and enlisted. And so was shipped off to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And Fort Lost in the Woods, Misery was the nickname of it. It's really a great place, but it is kind of like a throwback in time.
Yeah.
And then I was really innocent and really hadn't been exposed so much to the world. And then you go and you're with a group of women from all kinds of different backgrounds and a totally different situation. And the Army is a lot different now for women than it was, almost 30 years ago. And
so what was the biggest shock factor then? If you find yourself in a group of women from all over the place.
I went there thinking that I didn't have resources, and I was shocked by what women were coming there with, that almost all of us were trying to better our lives in some way. Mm-hmm. Whereas men, when you talk to the men even today about why they joined the Army, it's typically because they had a father, uncle, mm-hmm. or there was some desire to serve, and we all wanted to serve, but almost all of us, and I can't even think of an exception, were there either escaping something or trying to find a better path for our families or for ourselves. And so it was, you realize that we're not all, we don't all come from the same place. And when I thought that I had depleted resources, I still had so much more than others. And so it was where I felt like I was really responsible to be in the leadership type of role there and be a mentor to some of my my friends. And we are all still very close. We have a Facebook page and we stay connected and they've all gone on to do such neat things and have wonderful families. And but it was, I think that was the first time I really saw that there was a lot of, there was inequity in where we kind of our starting points are in life sometimes and so, as a young adult. And mm-hmm. that was really in your face there. And so, and then also I'd never been in a situation where I really didn't have any power and you'd have none there.
Yeah.
And back then all the drill sergeants were male and all the trainees were female. And so you ran into a lot of situations that I never had really been in before. So. Yeah.
Well, welcome to the real world.
Mm-hmm. You yeah, it really was. yeah. And I was a construction surveyor, so I got to learn a trade and just was able to be what happens in the military is that you're ingrained with what integrity is, what character is. You're taught that you're supposed to follow all orders, but the illegal ones. And then you would ask, like, what are the illegal orders? Like, well, that's you as a private have to determine whether the general that's giving you the order is ethical or not. And if it's not, you are responsible for not. You have to say no to some of these if you run into that situation, which is I've carried with me throughout my whole career that you have to, that just because someone tells you to do something, you have to always have that measure of is it the right thing to do or not? And if it's not, then you have a responsibility to say something.
So when did you get out?
So it took a while. So I went to the Oklahoma National Guard. I came back from being in Fort Leonard Wood for a couple of years and I wrote a check. I had beefed up. The Army gives you lots of carbs and I need to go buy some new clothes. I was going to go back to Oklahoma State.
Sounds like they know how, you know how to eat when you're in the
military. Yes, they feed you like hamburgers one day and the next day is like macaroni and the next day
is my kind of diet.
Chili macaroni next day is chili. So it's always like evolving the same menu. And there's always just a common ingredient across the board.
That's what I force feed my husband.
And I was super skinny going in. So I went in like main, like at 85 pounds and I came back to like 115. So, and so I was going to go back to Oklahoma State in style. I had about $15,000 saved up. I direct deposit all my money into Citizens Bank of Edmond where I now work, which is wild.
Not even realizing there was a connection there to be. That's interesting.
I went and one of my family members took me shopping and I wrote there in Edmond and I wrote a check at a women's boutique that's not open anymore. And a couple of days later, I got a notice from the bank that my account was overdrawn and that check.
Your $50,000 account?
$15,000.
I'm sorry, I heard 50. Yeah. $15,000 account.
And so then I found like it was when they would give you all your checks back at the bank. And so I found at this family member's house where all my mail was going, all of my bank statements, and they had been writing checks on my account the entire time that I was gone. And so I went from having $15,000, thinking I could pay for tuition at Oklahoma State, to not having anything. Being negative. They'd also sold me a car that they didn't own. The car was impounded. And
oh my goodness.
It was just...
Oh my gosh.
This really dark time. So, and it was August. So I was heading back to OSU and then I just didn't have a way. And so I went to the Edmond Library, a block or two from where I work right now, and got one of those really big college books because there wasn't the internet back then. And I just started going through and calling colleges with engineering programs, with ROTC programs to see if they would give me a scholarship. And so I have really good ACT score, good GPA. And I found a school in South Texas in Kingsville that was willing to give me a full ride if I could get down there.
Oh, man.
But I didn't have a car.
Oh, no.
And I don't know if you know where Kingsville is, but it's 3 hours south of San Antonio. And you know, there weren't like ride sharing programs. Yeah. And so I got rides all the way down to Kingsville. I really wasn't on the side of the road, but I took rides with people I didn't know.
Oh my, that's hitchhiking, isn't it?
I didn't have my thumb out, but it was like, there were people that knew people that got me there.
Oh my goodness.
And so I had a trash bag of my belongings I went down to Texas A&I and I walked into the ROTC unit there. Uh-huh. And the first person I met was Marcus Castilla, who quickly became my best bud. And we really, you know, had a great time.
He was the first person you met?
First person I met. I walked in the door and he was right there.
That's incredible. So much of your story is not having to be, but the Lord putting you in these places at just the right time.
It's almost like you're being forced into these spots. Like you're thinking that you have control and that you can plan this all out, but that you're forced, that he really had a hand in forcing me into some situations that at the time that seemed horrible. It was such a period of darkness, but those are the moments when I look back on that really forced that trajectory to change and were just those pivotal moments in your life that allowed so much goodness to come down the road.
Yeah, things you would not have chosen for yourself.
Exactly. And even though I never really felt defeated by that, people would tell you that, you know, you must feel defeated by this because there were people I trusted that betrayed me and that there were, you know, plans and hopes that were suddenly gone. So.
So you look back on that and, you know, there's probably at least some, I mean, I can't fathom a listener or two at a minimum who hasn't experienced that kind of family hurt. Mm-hmm. I mean, the jaw dropping something, you're going, what? I mean, how, so now looking back, that's been a good while. How have you dealt with that? I mean, as far as, how have you dealt with it? Let me not.
I mean, it's really difficult. I'm so fortunate that I have so much abundance of love in my life through my spouse and his family. And then my sister is just the loveliest person that you can meet. And so I think when you look at it, and how I've always framed it is that it was God's hand at work, and that it was that person was being used as an instrument, not to, mm-hmm. and that there's a little, you know, some illness, you know, mental illness mm-hmm. problems there that, and that I don't know what kind of harm they had as a child that caused some things to happen. But, you know, I never have felt a lot of anger with those situations. And have a really good sense of humor about those, like, probably things that are not appropriate to have a sense of humor about. But I think that that's where God has really blessed both my sister and I, and to be able to kind of laugh at some things that are really difficult, and just know that they were all part of a greater plan. So, and they also have given me reference points of what type of parent I want to be and what kind of sibling I want to be. And to know that there's, that we have a responsibility to do better than what we've been given in the past. So,
yeah, I actually can in some ways relate to a lot of what you just said. It makes me kind of wonder. So I got married just a little over a year ago.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And my husband and I, we have lots of conversations about how my childhood experiences, you know, how they shape and impact our marriage and what our, you know, what it will look like for us as parents someday. And so how exactly, can you think of specific ways you've seen those things shape your marriage and you and being a mom?
Oh, for sure. I mean, my husband came from exceptionally just where love just reached from his family. He's Hispanic, and it's just culturally just such a big hug when
warm.
I think about his family. Yes. It's just a just no holds bar embrace and just love and kisses all over your cheeks, which was like the opposite of how I would describe it. You're just like, you know, even if they're mad at someone, they don't stay mad long. It's just like this fierce love and embrace. And so it was so healing to have that with him, because he doesn't have a lot of the hangups, and it does carry with you. But he recognizes, you know, whenever I get, you know, where I'm scared that I'm going to lose something, because I think that's how it shows up for me, is kind of fear of abandonment or losing something. Mm-hmm. And sometimes then you can sabotage things because of that. And he recognizes it so well. He's just so healthy that he's able, you know, well, why don't you go to yoga? Or why? It sounds like you need to go take a bath.
Yes.
We were just having some conversations at work about that. You know, he just is able to diffuse some of this kind of hurt that starts bubbling up sometimes with us. And we started off our relationship was friends. I mean, we were best friends. So we were, you know, he knows everything about me and just saw all that hurt early. It didn't show up in our marriage. And so we were able to know how to handle that as we progressed on with our kids, because so many doors were shut to me, by my family. You know, I'm one that it feels like it's my responsibility to open the doors, provide opportunities for our children, but then also not forget that what made me who I am today is the Lord putting me in situations in which you had to persevere through it. And the adversity is what shapes you, and that you have to have that introduced in your life, so you can't make it too easy for your kids. And so having really high standards and giving them opportunities. So our children all go overseas as part of their high school experience. They spend a summer in China. And so they do 2 summers.
My goodness.
And so they're really able to, find, some challenges there, and there's not as much protection from a parental standpoint. And so they've all gone on to serve. So we have one child still at home, but our son serves in the Army and went through West Point.
Oh my goodness.
And our daughter is at the Naval Academy choosing to serve. And then
Jeepers.
It's incredible. I know so much to be proud of.
I think it's important to, and we share, I shared my hurt with my kids, and so they know where I'm coming from, and that, I want to protect them from that, but hopefully they can learn from it as well.
Yeah. Well, you've started to hit on that role of adversity, and that was a big, that was a kind of a watch point with me as I was really looking at your story and so I'd like to skip ahead a little bit then. And so now, after having been up in Minnesota for a while, then at the Federal Reserve for a while and kind of your early banking career, but then you find yourself, you were even at, I guess, a short time at Citizens.
I worked at Citizens and right before I went to the Federal Reserve, so like 1996, we lived in Hawaii and came back here. My mom married into the family that owns part of Citizens, and so I came back and worked here for minimum wage in the bookkeeping department.
Well, so then you leave and then you come back, but this time I don't think you had the intention of coming back. But you were needed.
Yes.
So let's start from that point in time, because I really want, I touching on this role of adversity and what does that look like to negotiate that path? And there's some really difficult stuff. So here you are, you're back. I think you're an assistant treasurer or something like that.
Yeah. So May 2009, my stepfather asked if I'd be willing to come back to the bank. I was a CFO at the bank that I was at. And they offered me a 50% cut in pay to come back to
Citizens. Yeah, here you go.
So no title. He said that he just really needed me. And my stepfather gave me away at my wedding. He only got married a month before Marcus and I did. And so, my mom was his first marriage, no children. I mean, I really respect my stepfather a lot. And so when he asked me and they needed me, I just really kind of dropped everything and ran. And my husband stayed up in Minnesota. My husband, who has an EQ that's off the charts, was like, okay, everybody's going to hate you when you walk in. They don't want you there. I'm like, no, maybe I'm only worth half of my salary. And maybe, I really had this very low view of what I could contribute. And, but he was very perceptive. And I came in and within 30 days found fraudulent $2 million of expense abuse.
Goodness.
Just in a 6-month period at a really small bank, rampant problems in the credit department. So banks, if you hit a 100% Texas ratio, you were at a severe risk of failure, and we were at a 200%.
Oh my goodness.
So we were the worst performing bank.
So you were
in
thinking,
Oklahoma.
What did I just do?
Yeah. Well, and through this time, our bank is the largest owners are employee stock ownership program. And so even though these team members didn't care for me very much, I knew that if this bank failed, it not only hurt the community, but all the retirements go away. And so they didn't really understand that as well. But I knew, I really felt called to be there. And it felt, until I went through SALT, honestly, I didn't really know how to articulate that because I didn't know that you really could be called to be a banker.
Mm-hmm.
But I really felt that way. I felt like I'm the person to do this now. Like I'm equipped through this experience to address this right now.
Sit so, here for such a time as this.
Yes, it really felt that way. And I would go to, I would work just nonstop, but I would make time to go to church and I would make time to go to yoga. Those are time my two things I did. And every message was just right. It just felt like that the pastor was speaking directly to me and just feeding that same, like that you are, that you're here for this time in this place. And then I would just get recharged to be able to go and hit the day. So I'd take the kids with me to work at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, drop them off at school, pick them up, and we worked till midnight. And then it ended up exposing our senior management at the bank and we had to have a full turnover of that. So as the assistant treasurer, I was basically running the bank in that we had no real leadership, except for our board of directors who were also you know, really in a flux themselves because this was their friends and their they were kind of blindsided by whatever everything was happening at the bank.
Well, and you were, I mean, what's really interesting too is, I mean, there's a lot of it that is, but I mean, you're thrust into a position of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your background. I mean, I don't know how much leadership you'd been practicing up to that point in time, but how old were you at the time?
I was 37. So I was, you know, I spent 10 years with the Federal Reserve in their management development program. So I really had some of those skills and the military too, that I think were perfectly equipping me for that moment. And even though I didn't have positional authority and really no one was giving me, it was not even delegating authority. I just stepped up into it. I just felt like I was not driven at all by career progression or ego. I mean, it was really just feeling called to be in this place. And and I just fully leaned into it. And I would cry when I got home, but I didn't cry when I was there. And I was truly hated. I mean, the community did not like me. There was lots of gossip about what I was doing there.
Jill, the story that took me aback was you are just going to go get your hair cut.
Yes.
And this happens twice. So would you just share this? I mean, if folks listening to this, now this will give you an idea of just how seriously hated she was, okay?
So I went across the street to get my hair cut. I have to get it colored every 3 months. And so I went and I've been at the bank for about 3 months and across the street in downtown. And the lady is cutting my hair. And then she asked me why I came back to Edmond. And I said to work at Citizens Bank of Edmond. And she literally puts her scissors down and just says, "You need to be careful. There's a lady that works there that's evil." I said, "I think you're talking about me." And she said, "No, you're so sweet. There's just no way." And she said, "This lady's firing everyone, changing this community bank into something. Citizens has been on this intersection for 100 years. So well regarded. The management had been there for 40 years. And so she continued to cut my hair."
You trusted her with scissors around your hair, around your head?
She felt terrible once she realized that, like, yes, this is the woman. So I relayed some of that conversation to some friends. Some childhood friends from Okmulgee had just recently moved back to Edmond. And so I had these people that have known me my whole life. Mm-hmm. It was such a blessing. And so they had someone that they thought could cut my hair in Nichols Hills, which is not very far away, but like a world away from Edmond. Uh-huh. Like those two worlds don't usually overlap. Yeah. And so I went to get my hair cut by this young man and he's cutting my hair and I am being careful not to say bribery. And he is dragging it out of me. And he finally says, "So where do you work?" And I said, "I work at a bank in Edmond." "Well, which bank in Edmond?"
"Oh, my goodness.
Citizens Bank of Edmond." And he's like, "Girl, you better be." I mean, he just goes in the same situation and ended up that someone in our leadership, their child also got their hair cut there. And so
So now you cut your own hair, right?
it was one thing to be disliked at work. If I think you can usually go and be anonymous.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't find that anywhere. I went to like Chamber of Commerce meetings and I would introduce myself and people would throw their hands up and say, "I know who you are." And they would turn around and walk off. And
goodness.
Same in the banking circles. I would try to get on committees and I would just refused. And the bankers really shunned me for a really long time. And so it was very lonely. And so it was a time where I really leaned on my faith and Marcus was not home. And so I was, really feeding myself kind of with my children and that love that you're getting around them. And I was completely transparent with them through this time. My son, who's 15 now, remembers being a four-year-old highlighting general ledger entries where mark, I need you to put a line through this because that means someone reversed an entry. And so it was all hands on deck with our family. And it made us really, when I look back on that time, it just fused us. Mm. It just was just such a fusion. And my boss, when I was working in the bookkeeping department there, was the only person that would work with me. She was now the chief operations officer and she was the only one that would kind of work with me through these issues I was finding. And everyone would make fun of us. But then one by one, as I saw the good that we were doing, we started getting converts over to kind of our side. And so it was just really extraordinary to see. We had 125 team members then. We only have 55 now. the author attrition just reduced our staff and went from 6 locations to 1, but took some really bold action and ended up orchestrating the fastest turnaround in the nation without adding capital. We had no money, so we had to really manage the bank super effectively to be able to get it to survive.
Jill, I cannot even imagine. Oh my goodness. I already had so much respect for you walking in today. And now I can't even put into words. That's incredible. And I'm trying to put myself in your shoes to imagine like what that must have felt like. You were saying that you really clung to your faith. Like that's what you clung to at that time. So what did that look like? Like what truths did you...
One of the most profound moments for me, I had slowly gained one advocate on our board of directors. The board was kind of not real happy that I was there either. And one became a quick friend. His name's David Penland. And there was a board meeting that we were in that was highly offensive and was destroyed me. I mean, just made me so angry and just pulled off scabs from, you know, all kinds of hurts. And he called me and it was like 10 o'clock at night. We were just in the throes of all this. And that we were I remember exactly where we were standing. And he said, Jill, you need to pray for them. And I'm like, you're right. I need to pray that they change their ways.
that lightning fall, fire from heaven.
But I was like, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. I am going to go pray right now. And he said, no, you need to pray for them that have abundance. You need to lift them up and just send so much goodness their way. And that healing that happened to me, how it just was such almost a selfish goodness that just washed over me when I was saying these words rather than the anger I was feeling, but just sending goodness their way through prayer, just healed me, just made all of that just feel so much better.
Yeah.
And so I leaned on that every time whenever I was faced with someone that I was feeling like this negativity and badness coming my way. I would just quickly just say a prayer for them and not try and selfishly just kind of wash over me. And every single person I did that for came a full circle and are just my greatest advocates.
My goodness.
You know, that really bears incredible. Underscoring. I mean, I can't tell you, there are listeners out there right now that are thinking right now, yeah, I'd like to call fire and brimstone down. Mm-hmm. But it what's so interesting is that you, by your being Jesus in the moment and just acting like, so what would Jesus do? Well, he would be praying for them. I mean, when he was on the cross, he says, Father, forgive them for they know not what they do. And so that act, but it not only was healing for, I mean, relationally, but it was good for you. That's what's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. I can still feel that. Just talking about it, I can feel what that feeling was. It's just so cleansing of just being able to let go of the anger and really just and then just giving it to the Lord to help you through something. It's just taking that time for myself and hearing the messages that needed to get to me too was just so important. And we can easily get betrayed in our time to not allow for that. And so I think those were the two big things for me was just how to pray for your enemies. And I'm sure there's more mature and eloquent ways to talk about it, but I just, that moment, it was just so,
that's what it was.
So profound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's also really, it's really cool to hear the way that the Lord, at a young age, like with everything going on with your family, how he taught you about mercy and grace and forgiveness. And you mentioned earlier, kind of the way that you viewed those things, like coming out of it, there wasn't this grudge that you felt, but he had allowed you to feel all those things or to experience the things I just said, mercy and grace and have love for those people and how he used those experiences in your childhood to shape what you would later come up against in your career.
Church was such a refuge for me growing up. I was so blessed to have a good church that took me in, and they placed, I lived with different members of my church during high school. I mean, it was an extraordinary place that really protected and provided me so many opportunities. My family just did a road trip to Yellowstone, and I have such incredible memories of visiting there in the past because I was able to go on a mission trip with our church in high school, and I didn't have the money to go, and so I had to tell them no, I couldn't go, and the church stepped in and allowed me to go on that trip. And you know, just it was a place in which I felt always protected.
Jill, I just want to jump up and down right now. I'm thinking I do, and thinking about the Lord's provision and faithfulness, like always, but specifically in your life and your story, like what He's done is incredible.
Yeah, it's there's just still so much to learn though. You know, I'm still just growing and trying to, you know, make sure that I'm walking in the path that I need to, and that you can get caught up with yourself and think that it's, you know, and let your ego get fed and make choices that you shouldn't. And it's just, it's always a good reminder to know where you're being led.
You know, something that also really strikes me is that I remember when, I was appointed district attorney, and I had been in that office for 16 years, and I got along great with everybody. I mean, we just had a great time. It was a great time. But then the moment I'm in the seat of authority, I mean, I could see the fear. And I learned at that moment, change brings fear. And so when you became the boss in that place, and the whole culture of the fear that was rampant in that place, I'm struck by how over time you have shifted culture and that is not an easy thing to do.
It is, give me any bank to turn around, but changing culture is, it especially, I was just constantly trying to seek inspiration of other leaders who had been, you know, ruled with a fist, which really my first few years there really was like that. It was a black and white, if you did something wrong and made a bad choice and you did it intentionally, then you couldn't be part of this team that was turning it around. Like we had to have unquestionable ethics as we were going through this turnaround. And so the grace I was extending was a lot more limited and not the type of leader that I normally am naturally am, but you had to make sure that everything was above reproach, and failure was not an option. That was the theme. Like we do not fail. We are accurate and perfect. But when you change a culture to them being, what really the turnaround affirmed was that we wanted to be around for another century. So how do we do that? Well, you can't do that with one person ruling the roost. Like it has to be a collective effort of everyone elevating each other and increasing the expectations of the leader and the organization always, that because organizations are not shaped by one person. They can be, the intention can be set out there, but it's shaped by the team. And if you can't get that to happen, then it's a long, long road. And it was for us. And so to get to the point where you're failing forward and that failure is encouraged and that we're experimenters and that we want to lead a way, to lead it down a path that hasn't been, no one's gone down before as a bank. Like, how do you do this? And so, I wasn't strategic at all. It was very much these divine interventions that allowed some goodness to start happening. And whenever I started really saying I wanted to change and knowing that I needed to, it really was if God provided these opportunities to do things like cash mobs or hurt on hurt or funny videos with the team that were just really inspirations that came. And so it really was the Holy Spirit, you really just felt like was at work trying to shape me to be a better leader and then also shape this organization to try to do good in its community and restore its own reputation so that we could go on and really do good.
So let's imagine that right now there's somebody listening that maybe they're not the one that controls, they're not the decision maker in the culture, but they are a part of a culture. So what do you say to someone who feels like they have no control, but they're in a toxic culture workplace that they can't necessarily leave. What would you say to them?
It's such a good question and such a hard question. And I've unfortunately have been in those types of situations. Mm. And the best thing I can say to do is just having faith that the transparency and candor that you provide, and if your intention is for positive change and not just complaining about the culture, but that I'm an agent of changing this culture, mm-hmm. and then having the courage, professional courage, I think is the most underrated skill that we look for in someone, that having professional courage to really, where you don't have positional authority, but you're willing to stand up and say something should be different. And just having that, approaching your work with almost reckless abandon, that you want to see this organization be the best it can be, because I think you'll be well received no matter how toxic the culture is. And the worst that can happen is that it has to leave this toxic, organization. But that's very rare. I hardly have ever seen anyone who stood up and said, how about we do this? Or I think this could help. I mean, leaders are typically a lot more insecure than we give them credit to being.
Amen.
and they want help more than what they're perceived to want.
Yeah, you know something, Jill, you just said right there has been something that has been glaringly apparent, that leaders need to be led.
Yes.
There are followers amongst leaders. And I can't tell you how many times I've observed big dog leaders, and they're really waiting for somebody to lead out.
Yes.
And they'll follow. Yes. If somebody will lead.
It's so true. And it's usually those that are the most intimidating that are the most open to it. It's and I hear people, leaders, asking me, how do I get this from my team? And so, I think it'd be very well received to just not wait till you have the position to do something. Have the audacity to do something.
Yes.
Don't wait for the positional authority.
I tell you what, and so if you're someone who is, finds themselves in an office like that, I just can't tell you the role of leading by encouragement can bring. I mean, just speaking, the way you speak in the office, the way you lift people up, speaking the uplifting things, and like Jill said, not being the whiner, not being the complainer, not the one who's back in the back stirring the pot, but the one who's speaking a different future on a place and seeing a different result. I'm telling you, you will be the de facto leader in that place, because people will come to you because they want to drink from your fountain. If you'll do that. So
it's so true. And otherwise you might interact with the printing company that shows up at your office, and they see this wonderful individual there that's not being recognized for the contributions they're making for the team. And there's another avenue that opens up for you. So that if you can really lean into that, it will be provided for you as far as where you need to be, and that you can escape, if not influence, where you are.
So how long did it take?
Oh my goodness, Wes. It was, I mean, it probably took 6 years, 7 years. I mean, there was incremental improvements, and mm-hmm. I can go back and see moments where there's milestones where it was a giant leap forward, mm-hmm. but it was so far in the depths, mm-hmm. Just so deficient in where it needed to be. It was just so far removed that it just took so long. And there was steps back and the giant leaps forward, and then steps back and then giant leaps forward. And those steps back were so hard, someone leaving abruptly, or some personal situation occurring, or, business interruption that occurs and that causes it, or a mistake by the leader to go back to how you didn't mean to be, but that it let mm-hmm. it expose, was then betrays the trust of the team. And even though it was maybe misconstrued or whatever it may be, but takes you 5 years back. And so you have to work so hard to get back there. And just the relentless authenticity that you have to have as a leader.
Oh, there's a great phrase. Relentless authenticity.
Mm-hmm. It that consistency of how you behave as a leader, especially when you're trying to come from a place of where you used to be and where you think you need to go, because they will always assume, your team will always assume, that you're really that person that they saw before. And so you just have to the only way to combat it is just consistently day in and day out living to be the leader that you want to be.
Okay. We are, I know we got to wrap this up and I don't want to, but
I know I have so many more questions.
There's stuff that but I got to ask you this before we, so did you get hit by a truck not too long ago?
What? I didn't know this.
I did.
Oh so, my goodness. Who are you, Jill? So you are Superwoman.
Yes, not my best moment.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So one of the hardest days of my career, just leaving a meeting that I really was like questioning, am I capable of leading this company and this team? And it was, I mean, literally walking out the door, talking with Josh, who was my right hand at the bank, and we're both in shock over something that just happened. And I push the button to cross the street in downtown Edmond. The light changes. I'm in the crosswalk. I see it's rush hour. The cars are kind of backed up. I see a big truck waiting at the light. He's got a green light because he's turning left. But he's impeded by the traffic. The person pulls forward, really short lights in downtown Edmond. He floors it.
Oh, no.
And I'm thinking he's just going to come up to the crosswalk. I'm now fully committed. It's four lanes of traffic, so I'm into the second lane. And I'm thinking he's going to stop at the crosswalk, but then I see him accelerating further. And
Did he see you? Oh, my goodness.
His GMC was right there.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, and you step out from the GMC.
I'm in the middle of the thing. Oh. So all I can think about is how clean his grill is.
For a moment.
Speaking of.
And then I'm on the phone with Josh. And I fly through the air.
Oh, my
He
goodness.
Automatically stops.
So that you weren't just tapped. You were like hit by a truck.
Threw me 12 feet. And then his car like auto stopped. It had like that hit something. And my feet, my shoes stayed where they were. And
my goodness.
And I land and my phone is right on my ear. And so I tell Josh.
Oh my gosh.
I've been hit by a car. Please tell my family I love them.
Oh my goodness.
And the phone goes dead.
Oh my gosh. Oh my goodness. I don't even know what to say.
It's July 30th. It's like 115 outside. It's like I'm scorched in my favorite dress.
Oh.
And so then, yeah, I get taken to the trauma one center. And
all right. Now I heard your like Tumi backpack.
My Tumi backpack, which I have right here with me.
Is that it?
It saved
yes.
you?
So I didn't know why you needed a ballistic nylon backpack, but apparently.
But now you do.
But I landed on my head on my backpack.
Oh my goodness.
It saved my life. And
you should do ads for them.
I know. I'm going for the endorsement deal.
There you go.
But yeah, so my wonderful friend, Scott Williams, you know, came to my aid told everybody he was my brother, ran in and to be with me. After I got hit, my daughter was a mile away and my assistant called her. And so she was able to be in the ambulance with me. And it kind of shook things into perspective. And it really, it was just kind of an intervention of like, okay, you need to get back on track of what's important. And this is a situation. This is not, it's not defining what getting hit by car as well as the meeting that I had just before that, that, you know, I was reminded of the care I have of a team around me. My right-hand person, Josh, my friends, Scott's like a brother to me, my family. And it was a totally different situation than when I was hit by kind of that bus of 2009 coming back to Citizens where I really felt all alone. It was different this time. My board came to my aid, take all the time you need. You know, there was so much love there. And it was just it was the worst thing, but also a really good moment to just feel all that coming and the community in the same way. It couldn't be a difference from where it was in 2009 and 10. So
aren't you glad it didn't happen in 2009? You know,
so maybe
ding dong, the witch is dead.
Oh my gosh. You know? Well, then the gentleman who hit me works in downtown Edmond and he came to visit me a couple of weeks after it happened and he was just wrecked and just, he had been on my mind. I'd just been praying for him because, you know, to think that you've hurt her because he really thought he had killed me. So.
Well, I did not realize that this had been as serious as
Jeez,
clearly.
Wes, making lies.
No, I did. I did not.
Well,
did
they
not.
Had to cut off my dress, and it was like my favorite dress.
I
got it on sale. It was
yes.
The lady was like, "I don't want to cut this off."
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. I need a picture of this dress, and I will take it upon myself. We will find you this dress.
Oh my gosh, I will.
We're gonna make it happen.
That'd be awesome. Yes.
Okay, but I do need to say this one thing before we let you go, and that is that do you know that Pokemon Go has been banned in China?
I did not know that Pokemon Go has been banned in China. So I'm Team Valor, level 40.
Okay, so yeah. Okay, yes. So there you go. Yes. So I knew you were a hardcore Pokemon Go.
Goer.
Okay. Thank you. I'm showing my age here. I had to look it up real quick.
I play for my kids. That's what I tell people. Yeah,
sure. That's really good. But you know, the reason why it was, now here, I'm reading this to say the Pokemon Go was deemed a quote big social risk by regulators who said it posed a threat to pedestrians and road safety.
So were you playing Pokemon Go?
That was my question. I was wondering, Jill, were you playing Pokemon Go?
I was on the phone with Josh. You can't play Pokemon Go and be on the phone.
I think the business call is a cover up.
Yes. I was not playing Pokemon Go. I don't play really while I'm walking. I play Pokemon Go a lot when I travel because it gives you.
Oh, fun.
I'm going to get you addicted to this because you go to Pokestops.
You go to what stops?
Pokestops.
I don't want to play.
Anything of significant value, artwork, historical places, and it tells you a description of it. And you can walk around just like a map of the city, like DC.
Oh, so you
is
hunt
so
for
fun.
It.
Oh, so it's like
yes.
Oh, so it's like a tourist.
It's a virtual world.
Guide.
Oh,
wow. Right. That actually sounds.
All right, Wes, maybe we check it out.
That sounds better.
I tell you, you're going to check it out and then you're going to be like.
Now I'm going to go like, oh my gosh, that's all I need is a. Anyway, but thank you. I'll get counseling on that. I'll talk to my wife about that so she approves it.
It's harmless too. So it's pretty fun. And my kids all grew up watching Pokemon. So it's nostalgic for me.
That's
so I just.
Fine.
And so they started playing, but they don't play anymore. And I'm now.
But mom's still on it.
Because I dominate.
They're like, Mom, get off Pokemon. Yeah.
Last question. So I'm only jumping in only because I'm trying to honor your time, which I haven't really done very well. Last question.
If God
answered your prayer and you were where you hope to be in 5 years, what would that look like?
I'm such a type A and I love to have goals, but I hope that I'm in the same place where I am now, where I don't have expectations of where I'll be, that I'm really, that I'm leaning into the moment, that I'm able to do as much as good as I can in the world. I see potential here in Oklahoma City of so many underserved areas and friends that don't have the voices that they need to have. And, you know, the more that I can be a conduit to help connect and help our city become the best it possibly can be. I'll just be thrilled with that. I think I could see that 5 years from now, me being less recognized and more of the people that I just love and adore that are doing such great work, that they're the ones getting the recognition.
Well, just as an aside, I just got to hand it to you because, I've got a good friend who, you know, John Dodson.
Yes.
Who
I adore.
Shared with me the profound story of his efforts to help folks like JB.
Yes.
Starting business in the Northeast Side, and John told the remarkable story of the impact of redlining and how they couldn't get a bank to give them help. Until you. And I don't think people understand what this redlining business is. I mean, do you mind just,
it's heartbreaking. Jonathan called me and told me about the opportunity of this development in Northeast Oklahoma City. And I'm like, I'm in. Let's tell me more about it. Let's go. I had no idea that 35 banks had told him no before that.
35 banks.
I'm going to break down because it is just, actually, 45 years, that area had really not had any substantial development dollars.
Well,
and they can't if you're not financing there. So redlining is where you won't finance in an area, geographic area, that you refuse to cross that line. And we use language that we can't find comps. I'm sorry.
I mean, seriously, that's the astonishing piece of this. So 45 years ago, they're redlining it so they won't get money in the area. And that's out of blatant racism. And then the reason why they won't give loans 45 years later is because there's no comps in the area because they haven't done loans. And it's only because, so it's like this never-ending cycle of unbelief.
So you never escape. There's never the economic prosperity. And when you look around Oklahoma City and the renaissance that we've had,
yes,
and then the absence of it in other areas.
You
see Capitol Hill, a similar situation, and Steve Mason, I have so much respect for him and the investments that he's made in turning like the Plaza District and other areas of our city, Capitol Hill with the Yale Theater, Jonathan with the Tower Theater on Northwest 23rd and then his development Northeast. But how important it is to be a catalyst and how much more fulfilling it is to not be the only bank in Northeast Oklahoma City. So the real joy came with the second bank financed something in Northeast Oklahoma City.
Because you guys stepped out.
Yes.
And again, this is about leaders are waiting to be led.
Yes.
And you did that like that. Yeah. And so I just got to hand that to you. And I've never gotten a chance to talk to you about that. But it was shocking to me. It really took, it knocked some of the naive off of me on what I couldn't understand. Why is there not more development in this area? And then I came to understand, oh my gosh, this is true.
And it's not, I mean, this deal had all the components of credit that you need. It was the only factor was the location. And that, by Jonathan stepping out and doing the first deal, which we did a healthcare facility, which there was a desert of healthcare in this area. Now they're getting the grocery store, desert of groceries. But across the street, he's got community members, Black entrepreneurs that are owners in the development and are launching businesses that will be employers of the community, and just that what you can do from intergenerational economic impact by developments like this, it's just so profound. There was just a Federal Reserve study showing the impact whenever you provide access to credit to lower income or underserved areas, the generational impact that you make with just that one loan. And so to see what you can do as a banker, the good that you can do, and so much has just been revealed in just the last couple of years. And so when you think about 5 years from now and where Northeast Oklahoma City looks like, what a Capitol Hill looks like, and how all citizens of our community can be elevated. And what's the great joy of that story for me is that when I said yes, it wasn't just me saying yes. It was 55 team members of a suburban, affluent bank in Edmond, Oklahoma, that were all saying yes. Like, let's figure out how to get this done. So that's been, having a team that has that collective spirit is just really extraordinary.
Yeah. It's really encouraging hearing about the way that you have leveraged the platform and the gifts and talents and abilities and influence that God has given you, the way that you've leveraged that for our community is so encouraging.
Well, that's a great way to put that. In fact, folks, that's something to put in your pocket and take home. It's leveraging influence. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got some amount of influence. What Jill was just talking about is leveraging theirs for a different tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to even be some grandiose deal. It could just be in somebody in your office. It can be somebody in your neighborhood. It's taking what you have and multiplying it. And so Jill Castillo, thank you so much.
What a
delight it is to get to live in the same town with you. I'm grateful. So
I'm
grateful
so
for you all. Thank you so much.
Well, and for the rest of y'all, we'll see you next time. So let me give you some concluding thoughts. If Hope were a person in the room, what would she say to us? Well, I think first of all, she'd say that you are fearfully and wonderfully made, that an unchanging God designed, built you, and sent you into a moment of history as part of his loving strategy to transform a chaotic world and make it good again. You are called as change agents. Hope would tell you that she flourishes when we listen to God and set goals for our lives that press us further toward becoming that person God has always been willing for us to become. Hope would tell you to set action steps towards achieving those goals. They don't have to be giant steps. Start with baby steps so you can be encouraged along the way. But hope would also tell you that you've got to not just make plans to step, but you must exercise the willpower to just take that next right step. Step by step by step gets you to the destination God has for your life. It's the long obedience in the same direction. And finally, hope would tell you that God sees us not as we are, but as we could become if we will dare. It's the same for our communities. As followers of Jesus, you are a sent people, and all humans should flourish because God's kids are in town. What evil thing dies because you exist? No one else is coming. You're the generation sent to your community in this moment. You're it. Press into God's purposes for your lives, and you will discover that hope abounds and that Jesus is still the God of the impossible. Thank you for joining us today on Hope Leads. I'm Wes Lane. Once again, I'd be honored if you would take a moment to rate this podcast, review it, subscribe, and share it with someone who needs hope. We want to thank Brianna Gaither for the song I Won't Rest Until from her album Vanity. Remember, you are fearfully and wonderfully made by a God who is willing for us to live meaningful lives of profound impact. I invite you to just show up and watch God show off.